I'm going to talk to you this afternoon as a mother who puts her hands straight up because I was once a first-time mother, and I was once the classic example of somebody who was done over because I let fear get the best of me. And actually, it's that started my journey. But here on the slide behind, you see a friend of mine. Her name is Soko, she's Japanese. And I was her labour support at Papakura Birthing Centre, which, you know, is a pretty cool place to have a baby. However, her main midwife, who is, I think, just one of the most brilliant midwives in the local area, and if I mentioned her, most of you would know her, Elaine Rudkin, was called away because one of the other women decided to give birth a week early. And so we were left with a standby midwife, and the atmosphere was so completely different. It was not funny. And I thought everything was going fine. And we got to transition, and suddenly the midwife got really hot feet and said, I think we should send for an ambulance and send you to Middlemore for a caesarean. I don't think you can do this. And Isoko just looked at me, and there was just fear right across there. And you remember Suzanne was talking about how even words can change your genes. Well, when you get fear and something like that goes bang, her body shut down. Labor stopped like that. And the midwife said, see? So I showed her the door and I said, we'll come and get you if we need you. She popped her head around a couple of times, but I told her, please leave. And fortunately, Elaine arrived just as Tairiku was crowning. And so I was shoved off that duty and shoved on the camera. And so that's the photograph that I took. And support made all the difference to this birth. I'd actually spoken to somebody who'd done a home birth with a Japanese mother. And she said to me that people who have English as a second language sometimes forget it under stress. So Isoko did something very un-Japanese. She asked her sister to be support person. And it was interesting because from the moment that midwife said, you can't do it, I had to relay everything to her sister, who said it back to her in Japanese. Fear had paralyzed her that much that she'd also forgotten her second language. And it was only after she had Tairiku. There's lots of cords around here. Watch where you're going, lady. That we were actually able to talk about what had happened. And this is one of the things that I had to talk to her about, because often we don't trust our bodies because something suddenly happens that makes us fearful. And words have a lot of control in many different ways. They can control our bodies, but sometimes the words spoken to us can control us if we buy into the argument. And the medical profession isn't always tolerant of people who don't like their words. So there can often be censure and judgment of you as a person. We all know that, what it's like when you don't vaccinate your kids and go to a doctor. They have plenty to say about that, and they're very impatient, and you can be thrown out of the practice. But here's the thing, to tie in with what Suzanne was saying this morning, it's a downward spiral. If you buy into words of fear, then just as Isoko experienced, you get this massive dump of cortisol, and it can change everything. It is a game changer. But in a general sense, even through pregnancy, if you have high levels of stress, then you are at increased susceptibility to infection. Now, I used to find every time I went to the doctor for my antenatal visit that I'd have to sit in the waiting room. And it became the joke that it wasn't the well child visit, it was the sick mum visit. Because without fail, I would come down with a cold or something afterwards. And it wasn't just the fact that my immune system's a bit different, it was also that I didn't like what was being said to me. But I was a first time mum, and I was compliant. And I was torn between what I wanted and what they wanted. And just as it says on that bottom list, I did lose my confidence. And when you lose your confidence, you have dysfunctional immune control. And that can methylate your DNA. So for my friend, what those words could have led to her if her sister wasn't there and I wasn't there, at the very least she would have had an induction because her labour had stopped. So they would have had to start it back up again. The worst she could have had was a caesarean. But, you know, we hung around. We waited. It took 50 minutes for it to start back up again. We got back in the swing of it. But let's have a look at something, because a recent study has shown something really interesting. Gregory 2013. This study showed a 35% higher rate of male autism after oxytocin during labour. That's either augmentation or induction. And his comment was, exposure to exogenous oxytocin during induction and augmentation may have a functional effect through as yet unidentified genetic or epigenetic factors. So we need to think about this oxytocin, because those of us who landed up having an induction, hands up, we believe, we're told, oh, it's just a natural, it's just what you would have produced in yourself. Well, actually, it's made out of mammals' brains, and the manufacturers are allowed 16% impurities, and it doesn't tell us what those impurities are, but you can guarantee if it wasn't impurities in there, they wouldn't say it. So we don't know what those impurities are. And this is a difficult issue for mothers, because being in labour is not a good time to be sideswiped. You are not having contractions, or you are having contractions and somebody said this is what's going to happen, and what do you do? It's a really, really hard position to be in. So it's really important for us to make very good choices about where we have births. But this is a Danish study. All of the women in this study were low risk. There were 839 of them. They all had exactly the same pregnancies. They were all considered to be equal. In the middle column, you see the midwives, and that's pretty much like Papakura Birthing Centre. And on the right-hand side, you see obstetric unit, which is sort of like Muddlemore. So if you look at this, you see a very interesting picture. In the hospital situation, which is very, very stressful, and where people mostly are intervention-minded and interfere, you see there is a huge difference in oxytocin. And these women are the same. Look at the C-section, 2.3 versus 4. Induction, 8.2 versus 18.5. Abnormal fetal heart rate leading to action, 4.1, 11.7. Now, we had a home birth with our second son. And the midwife we had was Joan Donnelly, very, very experienced. And we had a lot of discussion about my home birth, because the first experience in Middlemore was so stressful that every time we talked about hospital, my blood pressure would go through the roof. And our doctor, John Hilton, kept saying, well, you can't afford to go to hospital, because if you go to hospital, you're going to get a caesarean, because you're just way too stressed to go in there. But here's the thing. Joan said to me, where you get abnormal fetal heart rate leading to action, usually the baby in utero is responding to the mother's fear and the mother's stress. It's not that there's something wrong with the baby, it's that the baby doesn't like the environment that it's in. It can feel your hormones, it can feel the confusion. And instead of actually addressing the confusion, they do an induction. So all of these figures down here are markedly higher in the Middlemore situation than they are with midwives. But let's go back to Isoko. I mean, Papakura Birthing Centre is a really good place to have a baby. You just have to have one cog in the wheel that doesn't work right in a midwifery unit. We could have had an induction. We could have been sent to Middlemore. If Papakura had kept statistics, what might have happened would have been credited back there. And it wouldn't have been because there was something wrong with Isoko. It was because a midwife opened her mouth with words, and words are just so powerful. She could have had a caesarean section. Now, there is a big difference between an elective caesarean section and an emergency. In an emergency, usually the mother has had some labor, and so there are some really positive benefits for babies when it comes to labor. In an elective caesarean, the baby does not get those benefits. Both elective and emergency, this will apply. This first one, less diverse microbiome, and I'll show you some slides on that. With the baby that is emergency, this will not apply to such a great degree, but elective caesarean babies are at a very high risk of hypoglycemia because they don't get the catecholamines, the stress hormones that mobilize the glycogen stores so that they can have plenty of energy. With this, depressed breathing function and innate immunity especially applies to elective, and you'll see why shortly. Both elective and emergency will suffer from the last three. Hypermethylation of DNA, colostrum is different, and there's lower volume in the first week. But the very first thing that any mother is concerned about when her baby is born is, when is it going to take its first breath? Because breathing, for you and I, we're breathing and it's fundamental to life. I'm going to come back to the catecholamines. This line down here is the level of stress hormones in a baby at birth. Vaginal birth is one of the few times in life where high levels of catecholamines are required, well tolerated, and absolutely physiologically necessary. While the levels there are higher than a pheochromocytoma, which is a really nasty tumor on the adrenals, which is, you don't want to have that. The process of birth starts a very necessary, healthy, oxidative stress bonfire. Now, you've heard a lot about oxidative stress. There is good oxidative stress. There is bad oxidative stress. But this is a good process, and you'll see why shortly. And anyway, almost immediately after the birth, the mother produces the antidote in the form of beta endorphins. The catecholamines you see on that bottom line also zip the baby up, give a window of alertness which helps bonding with the mother, increases the glucose level, fuels and fuel mobilization, and helps deal with hypoxia. Because one of the things that many people don't realize is that when a baby is born, they only have roughly 60% oxygen sats, whereas you out there probably have about 100%, and I might have about 90 right now. This baby on the right, the lungs of this baby, is the elective delivery. There was no catecholamines. Now, if somebody went up behind you and let off a bomb and you got a fright, needed to run, one of the first thing that happens if you're actually aware of what your body is going is what? A dry mouth. Everything stops, everything, you know, this is one of the things that you notice. Adults under stress want to drink water. Why? Because of the catecholamines. This level of stress hormones also speeds up the metabolism and improves blood flow to the baby's major organs. So it stands to reason that the baby will need clear lungs, dilated bronchi, and good lung function to be able to get up to 100% oxygen saturation as fast as possible. This is the baby on the left that's had all the stress hormones. All of the water has absorbed. The baby is ready to go. But what happens next is very dependent on this. This is medical malpractice. This is an obstetrician. And he says, I am willing to testify and offer proof that immediate cord clamping at birth causes attention deficit disorders, learning disabilities, behavioral disorders, mental retardation, respiratory distress syndrome, and intraventricular hemorrhage and cerebral palsy. Now, when our first son was born, we requested not to have Even then, I knew about immediate cord clamping, and we requested not to have it. What I didn't know was that the obstetrician was not going to respect my wishes. She just clamped the cord right down where I couldn't see it. She didn't clamp it up there, she just went clamp down there. So even when you ask, you have to be vigilant. So we have to look at why do doctors clamp the cord. I was quite amused at a certain point when Suzanne and I were discussing it, and she said that she was taught in obstetrics that if you didn't clamp the cord, the blood would all run out. I'm sure that if mothers realised the damage immediate cord clamping can do, they would have second thoughts about letting anyone near them with a clamp, and their babies would be better for it. But the other thing is, isn't it funny that humans are the only mammal on earth that seems to have a clamp cord deficiency? Do you see farmers running around after the sheep and the cows and the horses? Do you see dock workers out in boats running around after all the dolphins and the whales saying, oh, well, you've got to clamp your cord, otherwise your blood might leak out? So why is it that humans are the only mammals where staff in attendance think a clamp is necessary? On the left is a glass. It's got 40% less. Well, that's actually an eyeball, 40%, could be wrong. So if you clamp the cord immediately, the baby is immediately minus 40% of its blood supply. That's like you losing 2 litres of blood in 5 seconds. That's a major hemorrhage. But that has more than one problem with it. Not only is the baby minus 40% of red blood cells, it's minus 40% of the albumin, which could be really important for bilirubin to attach to in the event of jaundice. It's also minus 40% of stem cells, which equates to about 8 billion. Was that the calculation you did, 8 billion? And that's going to be really important, as you see. Babies who have immediately cord clamped have a much higher rate of intracranial brain hemorrhages. Babies whose cords are clamped can suffer from anemia and various other problems related to that. For the mother, it's actually just as important, particularly if you're Rh negative, because the blood going to the baby has a function in getting rid of the placenta. If you can imagine, you've got a piece of elastic, now stretch it out and stick a stamp on it, okay? If you let the elastic shrink, the stamp will pop off. Now, if you clamp the cord, imagine the placenta as being the elastic. If you clamp the cord, that elastic stays like that and the stamp won't pop off. If you don't clamp the cord, all that blood coming in causes the surface of the placenta next to the uterine wall to shrink and the stamp pops off. So the slight shrinking of the volume of the placenta is really, really important. And this is why so many Rh mothers have problems if their babies are immediately clamped, because what do they have to do? Have you seen it happen? They wrap the cord around their hand and they pull it out. And this is where you get the mixing of the blood. And Robert Mendelson always said in his books that it was his opinion that the reason Rogam started to be used so much was because doctors were creating mayhem with immediate cord clamping. So it's really something that we need to think carefully about. Now, my next two slides are going to be slightly difficult and slightly mind-blowing. So we'll start with the first. I hope this works. This is your baby's blood circulation in utero and during labor. Your baby has a two-chamber heart like a fish, okay? Now, I don't know if you can see this very clearly. The blood is coming up here. This is the umbilical cord here. It comes up in another vessel, pops into here, and it shoots through a hole there called the foramen ovale, and it double backs. It comes up here. Now, the first quotient of the blood goes to the baby's head. Sorry, but they didn't put the head in there. But it goes to the baby's head, and when that blood is finished, it comes down here. It shoots through here, and it diverts to the lungs. Now, that is blue blood. It's not oxygenated, but it's only going to the lungs for nutrients. It's not going to the lungs for oxygen, okay? Then the blood that comes back from the lungs shoots up this little highway here. So that blood joins. You can see it's becoming purple, which means it's mixed blood. and it comes back out here into the placenta. So this is less oxygenated blood going back to be reoxygenated. So you actually have this system of blood flow. After birth, it's quite different. And I may have to flick it backwards and forwards. So, oh, I hate this slide. I've got a pair of scissors in it. We really don't need that. But anyway, what happens when your baby comes out? I mean, the baby's been squished up in the vagina. It's really crushed up. The chest is pushed. Any fluid that comes out of the nose is usually from the bronchioles. It's not from the lungs because that's all been absorbed. So your baby comes out, the head sort of pops out, and then the chest expands, which forms a bit of a suck. All the blood starts flowing to the peripherals once it can get its arms stretched. And you have this huge inrush of blood here. This bit here, called the foramen ovale, if you can imagine the old-fashioned cat door, it was a flap that the cat would go through and it would clang down and it would just... This has a flap here that actually passively stays open. But when this happens, the blood comes rushing in there, first of all, and bang, it shuts that flap down like that. It takes 24 hours for stem cells, microRNA, and RNA to seal that and form that into a solid wall. Now, the blood isn't going through that hole anymore. The unoxygenated blood is coming up here, going through there, diverting into the lungs to be oxygenated, to come down here to go back. So can you see the circulation has completely changed where it's going? The other thing that happens when that flap is slammed down, it provides a break where the ductosis, whatever you called it, that little highway, it actually pinches off. So it's no longer being used. So if you have a baby and you're told that, oh, your baby has a congenital heart defect, this foramen ovale has not closed and the ductus hasn't closed, you better have a look at your obstetric records, because this is a mechanical thing that happens with a rush of blood. And if you have the cord immediately clamped, there's a much higher chance that your baby will have a congenital defect. Well, actually, it's a cord clamp defect, in my opinion. So that's how the baby's blood circulation changed. Now, the second thing is that they never taught the doctors who felt that the blood would leak out, is that down here, see here, there's no white dots running here. Those two shut off fairly early on in the process. The blood keeps coming in here. The minute the baby has reached its full capacity and the blood flow stops, this shuts off here, up behind the liver. So you've got 1, 2, 3 shut-offs. You've got your foramen ovale shut-off, your ductus shut-off, 5. And then, last of all, the umbilical shuts off. So all of that has to happen in the space of about a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Now, those of you who've not had your cord clamped, you'll know that babies don't take breaths very fast, do they? It was staggering to me to see Isoko's baby. I mean, yes, he started to cry, but his first breath that he took, he took it in, he was startled, he let it out, and he didn't want to take another one. But you may not have noticed on that slide, his cord was not clamped. It was still full, everything was running in there. He let it out, he wouldn't breathe again. Did it feel like it was burning? So then they take another breath. And then as the oxygen saturations drop down a bit further, they are forced to continue to breathe, but they can do it in their own time. A baby who has his cord immediately clamped doesn't have that option, because the baby with the cord clamped doesn't have all of that oxygenated blood, the 40% that's missing, cruising in there to provide that time buffer. So for you ladies who are pregnant, I'm pretty sure you probably already know it, but just tell them there is no need for a clamp. Okay, you don't want it. So on that note, here is a picture of some twins who were born. They did not have twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, so who can tell me what the difference between this one is and this one? Right on. The obstetrician believed that because this twin was coming down really fast, hard on the heels of this twin should have his cord clamped immediately. Now, I think we need to think about this, because the practice of clamping really is an incredibly backward practice. Like many inventions, the manufacturer of the invention said it should not be used in the way it's used today. Margenis, he published it in a letter in The Lancet in 1899, said it should not be applied until the cord pulsation had completely ceased. And even then, it should be removed after 10 minutes. And the only reason to do that was the people who were attending birth didn't like getting blood on the sheets. This was nothing to do with, you know, they still had this appreciation of the normal process. Now, I want to take a step backwards because I've told you about the shutting of the heart. And Suzanne has told you about the epigenetics within pregnancy. But how many of you have thought about your placenta? It is the most amazing organ you could ever have. Your baby has been in your tummy and your baby swallows the amniotic fluid. You know, if they take 2 mils of your amniotic fluid, they can culture 80,000 viable stem cells just from 2 mils. So if you think back to those lungs that the blood was circulating in, your baby breathes in amniotic fluid. It's constantly bathed in stem cells. It's swallowing it down. That baby's gut is constantly infiltrated with stem cells and a whole lot of genetic material which helps your baby's gut develop properly. All along the edge of this amnion, there's a factory that churns out stem cells hand over fist. In the wart and jelly, right through the cord, stem cell factories turning out stem cells hand over fist. Your placenta is stem cells hand over fist. They know this. This is how you grow a baby. It is simply incredible. Now, in real life, and I'm putting this in because, again, it's another family that came to me. The father came to me. The mother was, I think, about 7 months pregnant at the time, and because she had no large intestine, the obstetrician said that there would be no trial of labour. It was no choice. She had to have a caesarean. But the father insisted on delayed cord clamping. The obstetrician said, "We don't do it that way to our babies." They call IVF babies our babies. And they had a big fight, and the family stood firm. And the father told me that even on the day, he had to prevent the obstetrician from putting that clamp on. But he also told me that after the birth, the nursing staff came and they were just absolutely elated that for the first time they had seen the cord not be clamped and they'd actually watched the process. And they were over the moon. And he was really happy about that, but I thought, what a tragedy. Why is it that in 2011, those midwives, this was the first time they had seen a delayed cord clamping? Oh. Why is this important? Because early life stressors affect the basic functioning on human cells throughout life, including shortening the telomeres. There's just recently been a study showing that children who have very stressful events at the beginning of their life, their telomeres shorten quite considerably. And those telomeres determine the length of our lives. Just recently, there was another study talking about a 115-year-old woman. How many of you want to get to that age? And they determined just before she died that she was functioning on 2 lines of stem cells. Where did she get them? 115 years ago, they didn't use cord clamps. She got her whole lot at birth. And we like to think that today the medical model is progressive. Now, Suzanne was talking to you about the bacteria. I probably don't really need to say very much because she's actually covered a fair bit of my talk. But just to prove to you that what she said is true, sterile fetus. What they did here was they took a poop sample from a healthy adult. This is here. And then they, you know, when you have your babies, the first thing you come up with is meconium. Have you two had babies before? Yeah. You have, so you know what meconium is like. It's really tarry, revolting stuff. So they took a sample of a healthy baby's meconium and using DNA fingerprinting, they found, oh, it's not sterile. How interesting. So they looked at meconium from a mother with gestational diabetes and with type 2 diabetes, and look, they're different. You have different amounts and different types of bacteria depending on your health. And they also now know that these same microbes are in the amniotic fluid, umbilical cord blood, meconium, placental membranes, and fetal membranes. So there you go. Don't let anybody tell you your fetus is sterile, because you've already impregnated it beautifully. And then they had this myth that breast milk was sterile too. So when DNA fingerprinting came along, they decided to look at it. Oh, we're going to prove that, you know, this is this, all of this bacteria comes from the tit. The only problem was the DNA fingerprinting was different. And when they actually looked at the DNA fingerprinting, what they worked out was, do you remember that picture that Suzanne showed you of the gut with all the bacteria and the mucus? Well, this is the bottom cell. Dendritic cells come up through the mucus, pull down bacteria in your gut. They take it to the mesenteric lymph node, put it into the blood circulation. It shoots through into the milk and your baby swallows it. But there's another trick that it has. Your body puts those bacteria into a macrophage, and it actually goes into your breast milk pre-sealed in this little immunological messenger, which says, oi, this is safe. You can trust this. This is from your mum. She won't give you anything you can't trust. So make sure you have good microbiome, because that's what your baby is relying on. So what do they know about the functioning of the components in 2013? I mean, We're telling you some things that they know, but in reality, this is what they say. The specific protective components of human milk are so numerous and multifunctional that science is just beginning to understand their functions. So you see, breast milk has it. Don't let anybody try to convince you that formula has it, because formula is dead, dead, dead in comparison to breast. Oh, Erin! You completely forgot. All right, everybody use your imagination. Erin was going to provide me with a little bottle, a jar of breast milk. So there it is, see? See that white stuff there? Don't you ever think that that stuff is milk that you can put in your coffee, because that stuff in that little bottle, as Dr. Mark Cregan said, now he was the guy who discovered stem cells in breast milk. And I mean, it stands to figure, doesn't it? You've got stem cells everywhere else. Why would you not have stem cells in your breast milk? This is what he said about breast milk. A new mother's mammary gland takes over from the placenta to provide the development guidance to ensure a baby's genetic destiny is fulfilled. So your placenta had all those stem cells and all that stuff in it that educated and grew your baby. Your breast milk has stem cells and a whole lot of other things I'm about to show you that continues that growth. And let's face it, you saw the little toddler walking around. They're growing at breakneck speed. They're starting to say words to you at 7 months. Hey, if I tossed you into China and you didn't have an interpreter, how many of you would come up with decent nouns 7 months after I tossed you into the middle of Beijing? These babies are just incredibly intelligent. Never underestimate a baby. But you mums who are breastfeeding, you can give your babies a fantastic head start. This is how. When you two start breastfeeding, every day, you will be giving your, every day from your blood to your milk, you'll be giving your baby 100 billion T and B cells every day. This is only the start. I'm going to give you figures that are absolutely going to blow your mind. Now, I can't talk to you about all of these things, and probably most of you know most of these. We've got all the usual, the foods and the vitamins and the minerals, and then there's other things like antioxidants. There's a whole list there, pre and probiotics. What I'm going to talk about are the bits in the red, because I have a story to tell at the end. And in order to understand the story, you have to understand a little bit more about breast milk. But the other thing I need to say to you, particularly you two women who are pregnant, what you have in your breast milk depends on your nutrition now. Because if either of you are anemic, your breast milk is going to have a higher protein level, lower fat level, some of these really important immune components like IgA, IgG, C3, C4 proteins are lower, and you have a lower calorie content. So just the fact that you're anemic is putting your baby under a bit of stress. So you really need to deal to that. And I mentioned to you the bacteria. I want to show you, I want to go back to the whole vaginal birth and cesarean and have a look at this. This is a vaginal delivery. The middle column is a non-elective. This is an emergency cesarean, okay? This column here is the elective cesarean. Now this is fascinating because if you have a cesarean and you go into Middlemore Hospital, it doesn't matter whether you're elective or non-elective, you're going to be given the same antibiotics and your baby's going to be treated the same. And yet, look at this. These two microbiomes are completely different in the colostrum samples. It can't be to do with the antibiotics because they would have had the same. This, the non-elective cesarean is much closer to the vaginal. So there's something that happens in the process of labor itself that orchestrates the bacteria that are going to go into your colostrum. Now you might think that only applies to colostrum, but it doesn't. It carries right through. And so what we have here is 6 months. Milk samples. This is the vaginal one. This is the non-elective cesarean. Now see how this one has come closer to the vaginal one? Look at this one though. It's completely different. So nobody I know has actually thought this through about why there is a big difference between vaginal birth and cesarean birth. But this is just so I can't pound you over the head enough about this one, and I'm sorry if it sounds. Let's go back, because this is part of my story. Breast milk promotes the programs, the metabolism and immune system. Okay? Think about that carefully. It programs the metabolism and the immune system. Breast milk contains factors that are capable of programming the infant's developing immune system and metabolism into a health-promoting model. Okay? Ballard, there's your PMID number down there. So, do you remember I talked about the placenta and the cord blood, the stem cells? Oops, what's happened here? Oh, that's just a pretty little picture of what Erin didn't bring me today. That's just milk under a microscope. These are the bits that I'm going to talk about in particular. There's other bits that build, but these are the main bits I want to concentrate on because otherwise I'd be here for a year. So we're going to concentrate on these ones. Suzanne's already talked a bit about this, and then there's extras as well. So we'll start at the beginning. And you mothers who are, this is your first pregnancy? Second. This is your first? Listen carefully. Stem cells in breast milk. Now, I'm not quite sure. These figures, this is per day, you will give between 50,000 and 5.1 billion or more stem cells. It depends which study you read. So I'm picking their guesstimates. I can't really give you an accurate figure, but it's amazing. This is a mammary lactocyte that somehow sort of stuck in the picture. All of these little pretty things that are purple and red, those are stem cells. They are used for tissue repair, regeneration, and microchimerism. Now, this next slide is specifically for you. You're the first-time pregnant mum. Because before you got pregnant, you didn't actually have the means to feed your baby in there. It hadn't been built. When you got pregnant, a whole lot of stem cells triggered inside your breast, myoepithelial luminal lactocytes, in order to make the it looks like it sort of like cauliflower where all the breast milk are. You'll see some pictures of that later. So you're how pregnant are you?
Just over 37 weeks.
Well, you're nearly there. You're ready to go. You're everything's ready to roll.
I'm licking and everything.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's what happened when you got pregnant. All of that started, and as we go through, you're going to see. But now that you are all ready to go, this is what you can do for your child. These are stem cells that they found in breast milk. This one here creates nerves. This one's liver cells. This one's pancreatic cells. This is bone, cartilage, fat, and those are just a few. I mean, I could carry on for weeks with lots of pictures, but in the end, it's just pictures. Can you see how amazing? Those stem cells that built your machinery are now building stem cells for your baby. And that's not where it stops either. But this is what your stem cells built, see? This red area here is where the milk is secreted. The pink bits are Golgi apparatus, you probably don't need to know that. And in here are microtubules, because some of what goes into the milk doesn't actually go through those base cells. It goes in gaps that are between the cells. This bottom one is a similar one. The green parts are where the milk is secreted, and my notes have disappeared for the rest. So this is a really interesting article written by Ermac. He actually wrote two, and he dedicated both of these articles to a wet nurse, because what he was studying was a child who had a clinical manifestations of a genetic disease but couldn't be fed by his mother, and they employed a wet nurse. And you know how medical people write the ifs and buts and maybes and all the rest, but this is what he said: transfer of wild RNA from a healthy wet nurse could result in permanent correction of clinical manifestations of genetic disease. So actually, it's not genetic disease, it's epigenetic disease. Like the two agouti mice, they both had the same defective gene. One ate right and one ate the other way. And so, you know what I mean. Now, quite apart from stem cells, Suzanne talked about the microRNA that zips up to a messenger RNA and either dissolves it or stops it. You make microRNA hand over fist in your breast, but it's packaged into little things called lactosomes, which are given to your baby, and I'll show you how that works now. So in your breast, it's a very simplified, he's done a square thing, but actually the breast cells have got layers and layers of these fingers that come out like this, because they're constantly blebbing off things and closing over. So inside that round bit, you've got all these fingers that stick out and are blebbing off molecules. Is this giving you a new concept of milk? It's not something that comes out of a bottle. So this should actually be a finger like this. Now, Ermac, he's put here MFG, which stands for milk fat globules. Actually, that's not quite right. The problem is that up until very recently, lactosomes have been called exosomes or milk fat globules, until they discovered that milk fat globules and lactosomes are actually completely different. Milk fat globules have a different purpose, and I'm not going to go into it, but lactosomes are covered with completely different phospholipids. So as this area here comes out, it has a membrane around it, and then the surface of your mammary glands bleb off a triple phospholipid area in here, but it traps in here in what's called the cytoplasmic crescent about 100 different proteins, as well as different sorts of RNA. Some of those proteins are actually to protect the lactosome from being attacked by complement, but the other proteins have a different function, and I'll show you what happens. So this is you. You're leaking out, you're ready to go. This is your baby. This is somewhere inside your baby, a cell. The lactosome releases the genetic material, which is taken in. There's a special process, calveolar something or other, calveolar mediated endocytosis, for those of you who like big long words. Let's just say it sucks it in. Oh, and the medical literature calls this a lipid raft. I prefer to call it a Trojan horse. So this comes in here, it now has another double skin, but here's the nifty thing. This bit, this inside bit, sticks through little like hypodermic syringes, which excretes out these specific proteins, which pull it into the endoplasmic reticulum. And using these molecules, the RNA is unzipped, but using reverse transcriptase, it's taken into the nucleus here. You saw that green, big green picture that Suzanne put up. It finds the area of DNA that it's to target, it undoes it, it redoes it, and fixes it. So this is, when Ermac's talking about a genetic disease, he's not. He's talking about fixing it epigenetically. Okay? And this is what you're going to be doing every day. There are 602 unique microRNAs in breast milk. It targets at least 9,074 genes. 2,691 are metabolic. This one type, microRNA 181, is to do with TNB, so there's actually two types of it. Every day, you will be producing 130 million copies per litre of milk that you produce of that one type. Now, if you think that's a lot, have a look at this chart. Don't worry about the... Okay, I'll go through this. Here's your two types. There's your 130 million copies, okay? Just of those. Well, what about these? How many million are you going to make of these? And these are your T and B cells. There's another three there. This is your innate immune system cell. This is your neutrophil, T and B cells, blood cells, muscle-specific, pancreas, liver cells, neuronal cells, and we could keep on going. Are you starting to get this picture? I mean, I've told you how many genes it... This is epigenetic remodeling and programming of your child's immune system and metabolism. It has a program that it goes through, and it has a very, very specific order. And if you think that's only just at the beginning, have a look at this. This is 0 to 6 months in pregnancy. Big amount. You might say, oh, look at that. Well, that's not very big. But considering how many trillions of microRNA you're making, that's still a hefty amount of genetic programming you're going to be doing after 6 months. Okay? So don't ever be tempted to give up at 3 months if things get difficult. Just keep it in front of your eyes that what you have got something that nobody else has got. And your breast milk, in terms of microRNA, will be different from yours, just like the wetness was different from the mother of the baby. And I've actually had experience with that myself, because after our second son was born, a friend of mine had a really nasty delivery, and she got an abscess, which pretty much took up half of her breast. So I pretty much fed her child an expressed milk, gave her milk, whatever I could do, for a whole month. And they went on to have three children, and they have a big family history of allergies and eczemas and nasty skin. That boy was the only one out of the three children that didn't have nasty skin and nasty eczema. And while I might have my own health problems, at least I might have helped to fix a bit of his. And it's not genetic, it's epigenetic, and this is something that only we as mothers can do. Next thing I want to talk about is Hamlet. This is another one that you've got. Your baby will swallow from another sort of lactosome. This here, it's alpha-lactalbumin. It's a protein. That's it on the left. This is a really nifty device. You provide that to your baby, and the baby's stomach acid opens that up, drops off that calcium molecule, and also sends a signal for oleic acid. It actually sends a signal out. And what the Hamlet does is it refolds around the oleic acid to form this molecule. Hamlet stands for human alpha-lactalbumin made lethal to tumours. And one of its main jobs is patrolling your baby's gut, because your baby's gut is growing at a phenomenal rate. Hamlet targets the cells in the baby's gut that aren't genetically stable. And what it does is it triggers death of that cell. It alters the cell membrane, goes in, activates organelles, proteasomes, mitochondria. Then it enters the nuclei and bing, both the Hamlet and the cell die. And then the baby's immune system clears it out. We know from the studies that have come from Sweden, where all this work has been done, that breastfed babies have a 9 times less amount of cancer than formula-fed babies. And it all comes down to Hamlet. But that's not all that Hamlet does. In this study, they took the pneumococcal bacteria. There's a vaccine called Prevnar. They took that pneumococcal bacteria, the pneumococcal is the blue line along here, and they took cancer cells. And they put them with the alpha-lactalbumin, which was the one on the left, you know, before it had been digested. Nothing. Then they took the same quantities and put them with the Hamlet, which was the alpha-lactalbumin and the oleic acid. Look what happened. And these are levels so easily achieved within breast milk. And this is one of the reasons why a breastfed baby from a healthy mother will hardly ever get pneumococcus or Haemophilus, any of those bacterial diseases that are encapsulated, because Hamlet's job is to nuke the lot. The next thing we're going to talk about is transforming growth factor beta. These are large proteins which have many functions in the body. Three different types have been identified so far. It's vital for bone, cartilage, cell proliferation and differentiation and immunity. It has a role in every single cell in the body, which is understandable because, I mean, look at how fast your babies are growing. It is really, really important, but it has another function. It can serve as a graded morphogen, causing cell differentiation in developing cells, and can govern the pattern of tissue development in the process of morphogenesis and the positions of various specialized cell types within a tissue. And you will see how important that is in a moment. This is another one that I need to deal with. There are at least 21 different calcium-binding proteins in breast milk which are involved in cell-to-cell communication, cell growth, cell structure, energy metabolism, intracellular signal transduction, which is what Suzanne was talking about. You know, you saw the membranes with all those little things on the top and they were taking signals in. She had all those little things, but what you need to imagine is it comes along, plops onto the top of those things, and then just imagine a whole lot of lights going on down the line. Little light come on here, message sent, little light, little light, little light, oops, into the nuclei. This is what this is all about. The S100B are concentrated in glial cells, Schwann cells, astrocytes, really specifically neuronal subpopulations, but they're everywhere. They also have other functions. But I have only dealt with those because now I want to tell you about a little girl called Cassandra. Cassandra's mother was a health professional, and Cassandra was born with a ventricular septal defect. Here it is, a hole between here. So it's not the foramen ovale or the ductus one, it's this one. It is a congenital defect. There is no cord clamp involved here. She was advised to stop breastfeeding immediately, to put her baby on formula, to vaccinate to the hilt, and that they would operate on Cassandra at 6 months after all her vaccines were complete. The mother refused. She's a nurse working in a hospital, and she refused. And the doctors were not at all happy. So she rang me, and I provided her with lots of medical articles on stem cells, you know, the early stuff of what I've been talking to you. And even though I didn't know as much then as I know now, she had the courage to run with it, and she even provided some of the articles to the doctors, but they were still sort of, oh, well, you know, we need lots of thousands of double-blind studies to know whether or not this really might work, you know, we really think you should do this. But she said, no, I'm not going to do that. So they insisted on sequential scans with this baby. The last scan when this baby, Cassandra was fed for 5 years. The last scan at 4 years found nothing. And they couldn't say, oh, we misdiagnosed, because they insisted on sequential scans, and with every scan it got a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller. So it is my opinion that everything that you two are going to be providing, the stem cells, microRNA, messenger RNA, all the stuff that they don't even know about, that I haven't been able to talk about because they haven't yet stuck it there in PubMed for me to pull out, is crucially important for you. And don't ever let anybody say to you, your baby has a congenital defect, there's nothing that you can do about it. Because I believe, I mean, Cassandra's living proof. I believe there's plenty you can do about it. You have to trust your body. You must not give in to messages of fear. That will cripple you and it'll stop you being able to think. The very best thing, if somebody tries to put fear into you, is go to Google Scholar or PubMed, or if you can't even think straight enough, pick the phone up and ring me, and I'll think on your behalf. Now let's have a look at just a couple of additional benefits before I wind up here. 70% lower chance of a breastfed baby getting type 1 diabetes mellitus. Wow. Now, if they could patent a drug for that to be given to a baby, they'd do it, wouldn't they? But they don't mention breast milk. Higher IQ, Caveat, it depends on your diet. If you eat junk, you get junk, you give junk, and you get junk. Okay? Autism rates are lower. The longer a mother breastfeeds, the less rates of autism they see. The shorter you breastfeed, the more rates. Now, I don't think I need to join the dots for you lot on that, do I? There's so many factors in breast milk that can deal with that. Breast milk is the ultimate epigenetic modelling. But if you don't breastfeed, what you get is formula epigenetic modelling, which is completely different, because the microRNA in cow's milk formula is based on what is necessary for a calf to grow really fast and really big. And that's why when you look at studies where they look at breastfed, cow's milk, and soya formula, there is a 10% excess weight always in the cow's milk. That's why those of us in the 80s who breastfed got into such a lot of trouble, because the average growth graphs in the Plunkett books were based on what was normal for formula-fed babies. And you know what? Breastfed babies don't put on weight like that. They do not become little Michelin men usually. You know, you remember the little, how many parents used to call their babies sausage man. So we would be saying, oh, you really need to give your baby solids. He's not growing properly. Well, that was a warped mindset based on the fallacy that formula is your normal default. Formula is not the normal default. Breastfeeding is the normal default. Even with soya formula, you're going to get a completely different growth pattern, completely different microRNA, completely different bone structure. Put the three together, and what have you got? You've got three different species. You're a human, and your baby needs human epigenetics, human remodeling. That's what you're there for. If you weren't there for that, you wouldn't have this. Why is this so important? I mean, I know we sound like we're ranting, but this is a program. It's an anti-inflammatory phenotype. What your breast milk is constantly doing, those stem cells that you got in the cord blood, they're anti-inflammatory. They damp everything down so that the baby's bacteria can establish in the gut. Your breast milk is anti-inflammatory. Your immune system will stay slightly different just in order to keep your baby anti-inflammatory. Your baby can deal with viruses and bacteria because your breast milk is the immune system to deal with that. Your job is to keep your breast milk anti-inflammatory. But every time somebody sticks a vaccine into your baby has to respond. In what manner? Inflammatory. This is the whole program, to keep it anti-inflammatory. At a time when tissue growth and remodeling events are taking place at a rapid pace, thus the inability of the neonate to respond to infection with encapsulated bacteria may be the risk the organism takes for successful development. Now, can you see the mind shift here? What does he leave out of the equation? He says a baby has an inability to respond to encapsulated bacteria. Yeah, if the baby's on formula, that baby has an inability to respond. You mums respond for the baby responds against it. There is no inability to respond. Your baby is completely dependent upon you for reprogramming successful developments in a healthy model. What might happen if you try to improve it with vaccines? That is what part 4 will be about. Thank you.